signing papers, so we're going to begin in, and go through the order as it is listed there. So we'll begin with Claire Harrison from Next Up. You're at the Make Poverty History rally. We talked about this a little bit yesterday and afterwards, and you've got sort of your good solid families. You've got your sort of NGOs, and they're the liberal NGOs, and they're all saying all this kind of stuff. What is it? Make poverty history better trade, drop the debt, and whatever else it was. Anyway, everyone can recite it. They all know. They've all seen Brad Pitt doing the three clicks and all that kind of stuff. They've seen that, and they think, oh, we're doing politics here. And then there's a whole load of, and there's also kind of, other organised marches, Marxist organised marches, like, Socialist Resistance, etc. And then you've got some anarchists or and others who are running around Gleneagles trying to wire couples and things, trying to get through wires and shut down a summit protest. And I want to argue that from the kind of point of view of the politics of demand, these anarchist practices, this running around, undercover, trying to wear camouflage and shut down summits, it just seems utterly pointless. It seems completely negative. It doesn't seem, it just seems disruptive and pointless. And I'm going to argue that by using Day's politics of the act, we can actually suggest that there is another mode of politics. And if we look at it from this kind of point of view, then we can actually see it as a productive and a creative mode of politics. But this is something that most people, both sort of in IR and in the mainstream media, they can't see because they are assuming the politics of demand. So Day identifies his politics of demand as actions orientated to ameliorating the practices of states, corporations and everyday life through either influencing or using state power to achieve irradiation effects. So he's suggesting the politics of demand is completely oriented towards using the state to kind of either get influence or to have your rights or recognition achieved through the state mechanism. Now Day is, I'm not quite so sure I take the same position, but Day is very, sort of suggests that this is a useless type of politics. He kind of, privileges the politics of the act over this, because he says that all this does is it changes the content of the structures of domination and exploitation, but it doesn't change their form. It just perpetuates the status quo by going to the state and expecting the state to sort of achieve, to give you your rights or your recognition. You're actually just perpetuating the whole system of domination and exploitation in the first place. So he kind of argues that most of the old social movements and what he calls the new social movements, which is kind of identity-based movements of the 70s and the 80s and early 90s, is based on this kind of logic of hegemony, which kind of just seeks to perpetuate the systems of control through the state. So he then makes a distinction between new social movements and newest social movements, which is interesting, where he suggests that this kind of the anarchist-inspired activism of the global justice movement, the anti-capitalist movement, is a newest type of social movement, and that is because they are actually using a logical affinity, and they're also just turning the idea of what politics is on its head. He argues that the politics of the act breaks out of the cycle of demand and response by, quote, giving up on the expectation of a non-dominating response from structures of domination. It means surprising both oneself and the structure by inventing a response that precludes the necessity of the demand and thereby breaks out of the loop of endless perpetuation of desire for emancipation, unquote. So he's basically saying that that rather than actually trying to perpetuate these systems of domination and control, they're taking a more anarchist-inspired approach by kind of not assuming that the state can actually ameliorate all of the problems that they have. In fact, what normally happens, he argues, is that the politics of demand, addresses its concerns to the state, but the state is actually unable to produce the desired outcome of emancipation. And if it does, it then only precludes another group from having their rights met. So it's a kind of never-ending cycle of demands not ever actually being achieved. So he argues that it's a kind of politics. So I'm going to argue that the politics of demand and the politics of the act, as suggested by Dave, doesn't really ever then go on to conceptualise what this might look like in practice. So I'm just going to outline three characteristics that I think are part of the politics of demand, kind of exemplified by a Marxist and also social movement theory. So those are pretty much the main in IR and social movement theory, the dominant perspective is this politics of demand. And then I'm going to just outline what I think the politics of the act might look like. And that might be kind of exemplified by anarchist practices. So politics of demand, for me, is characterised in three main ways, which are an orientation to the state, centralised organisation, and kind of knowledge production before action. So orientation to the state, I mean, as I said, the politics of demand conforms to the narrative that we're kind of familiar with because it's assumed that there's two protagonists, there's a group of people who have a problem, and they generally require either rights or recognition from the state. There's also the other protagonist is the state or the institution that they think is going to give them what they want. And Marxist politics, tends to assume this kind of relationship without, even if it's not always explicit, implicitly that's what they're assuming. In the paper I've written, I look at sort of Morton and how he characterises Zapatistas in a kind of neo-Gramscian way, which actually although he kind of talks about the war of movement and manoeuvre and the war of position, in fact they're actually both orientated to the state. So although it's progressive, it's still orientated around this whole idea of demanding things from the state. And secondly, centralised organisation. Well, I think we might have mentioned the horizontals and the verticals thing yesterday, and that's kind of well-known activist parlance, isn't it? The verticals are kind of, in my opinion, sum up the kind of politics of demand in the sense that they strive for efficiency and structure, and they have a set of goals that they wish to achieve, and that success can be measured by achieving these particular goals. So they view mass mobilisations or events as the condition to persuade people to support the predetermined political ideas and demands that the leadership has already decided upon. So, which is interesting because when we were talking about building the movement yesterday, to me that sounds like quite a kind of a Marxist. I'm not saying that it's not something that anarchists would do as well, but to me, building the movement, the language of that kind of thing suggests it's this kind of thing. We need to build it because there's a future and it has to go forward, and we have to do it along. And the leaders have already decided what that future is, and that's how a Marxist or a kind of globalised resistance, social, that kind of thing, they would take it on that term. So I find it interesting that the language that we used yesterday. So they don't really require a lot of support from their members. This kind of vertical organisation, it just requires the members to legitimate the leaders and say, yep, that's fine. You do that, that's fine. We'll let you. It's not really about sort of taking action, taking control. It's about being told this is what you'll do. And this is kind of more of an instrumental than a sort of performative, idea. And this leads into the third aspect for me, which I'm at the moment not very happy with, but calling knowledge creation before action. So if anyone's got a better name than that, that'd be brilliant. And that, again, links into the idea that we have to be informed of our false consciousness before we can act. So it's about, a leadership creating a narrative through which they define these are the demands that we have, these are the things that we're unhappy about, and this is how we go about acting. So obviously that's kind of a Marxist idea, but also you get that in social movement theory, where framing theory suggests that the leaders define a grievance, and they do that, by the way, not based on which grievance they think is really important, but which they think will actually gain them success by orientating them to the state. So they look at kind of what the state, where the state is, and then say, right, okay, let's go with this grievance rather than that one. So again, it's this whole idea that everything is orientated completely towards the state and how they can achieve premeditated goals through this. So these activist leaders are creating frames to educate and sort of commits people to action who do not realise already that they need to act. So it's kind of a, you know, you lose that there's no kind of ability for most of the subjects to decide they want to act. They're told this is what you'll do and this is when you'll do it and this is how you'll do it. So that's kind of what I suggest is a politics of demand. So kind of orientation to the state, vertical organisation and kind of knowledge creation from leadership before action. In the paper I've suggested a few movements which I think are not groups or movements which I think are not kind of or are disrupting this logic. I use examples of food not bombs, and because they don't want anything from the state, they're just doing the stuff that, you know, and other kind of anarchist movements. So I haven't got time to talk about them now, but they're in the paper. So the three things that I think sum up a politics of the act, and this is again where I'm kind of trying to build on Day, because he sort of gets there and then I think gets a bit stuck. He doesn't really go any further as to how it might look. So there's kind of aspects which are along the same axes as the politics of demand, but kind of at the other end of the spectrum. So the first one is obviously not being orientated to the state, and in some cases withdrawal from the state. So there are lots of theorists who talk about this, but for example, Hacking Bay, you know, temporary autonomous zones, he's talking about kind of, he says the TAS is like an uprising which does not engage directly with the state, a guerrilla operation which liberates an area of land, of time, of imagination, and then dissolves itself to reform elsewhere and elsewhere before the state can crush it. So it's about being completely withdrawn from the state, about not assuming that the state can actually give you what you want, and therefore you kind of just have to do these things yourself. And by building on Landau, you know, Gustav Landau, who suggests that by not the state is a relationship, and by not engaging with that relationship, we can drain power from the state by just kind of getting on with politics without it. So that would be the first step. Secondly is decentralised organisation, so the kind of horizontal side rather than the vertical side, which I think privileges kind of relationships and gives everybody the chance for their voice to be heard, and you know, it suggests that everybody's opinion is as important as everybody else's, which is clearly not what we see with the vertical side, because they're kind of more instrumental and need to get things done first, and then they'll worry about that kind of stuff later. So so it's about sort of recognising and respecting differences, he was talking about yesterday, you know, it's a kind of the whole idea of deliberation and democracy. Thirdly is an kind of equality through action, so a sense that that anybody can act and they don't have to be told how to act by somebody else. And Rancière sort of talks about this. He sort of develops a conceptualization of politics based on the idea that to be truly democratic, politics has to be based on a presupposition of equality. So that's to say that democratic politics must be based on the understanding that all those who take part in the struggle are equal, and they're also equal to the people who dominate them. So this opposes kind of types of politics that formalise hierarchy and the organisation of roles. May explains that, quote, simply to demand equality is to place the bulk of political power in the hands of those who are the recipient of these demands, which is kind of the politics of the demand. But to demand equality is to be a victim, even if an angry and an organised one. Alternative to presuppose equality is to be active. Okay, so that's the whole idea, that we're actually all equal before we start, and therefore to act we do not need to be told by somebody else how to act, but, you know, because we're equal to anyone else who's acting. And I think, you know, that's the kind of takes on the direct action aspect of anarchist politics, which is a core sort of tenet of anarchist movements. And so I kind of argued that the politics of demand and the act can be understood along these three axes of kind of orientation to the state, withdrawal, you know, sort of vertical, centralised, hierarchical organisation, horizontal, flat kind of organisation, and that thirdly, the idea of kind of how it is that we can act, like whether knowledge has to be created and we have to be told how we act, or whether we are all equal to act in any way we want. Now, I'm not suggesting that we kind of, I'm not entirely sure I'm suggesting, as Day does, that we privilege one hugely over the other, because I think it's, like you were saying yesterday about, you know, there will always be someone who dominates, you know, the conversation. There's no such thing as kind of having utterly flat power relations, and I think that we were probably all, although we might be more sympathetic towards a kind of politics of the act, it doesn't mean to say that we will always, all the time, achieve that. So it's not, I think Day sets it up a bit simplistically because he sort of says, there's the politics of the act and that's really good, then there's the politics of demand and that's not very good. Because actually all of the time we're all kind of merging those two and kind of getting sort of mixed up in the two. So it's not a simple case of one or the other, but they're both kind of different modes of politics through which we might be able to kind of understand what's happening. And that if we look at, kind of go back to the beginning of the example and the kind of the anarchists, you know, going through the undergrowth trying to get to the Glen Eagle summit to shut it down, you know, it seems completely pointless if you look at it from the politics of demand because they don't understand what you're trying to get at. But if you look at it from the politics of the act, the kind of direct action end of the spectrum seems to make much more sense. It seems actually to be a productive and a creative relationship rather than just disruptive and negative.
Right on top of it. Okay, thanks for that clip. Our second paper today is from Erica Cudworth and Stephen Hopkins of UEL.
Some insights from complexity and anarchist thinking to suggest a different way of considering international relations. Now, why might we want to do that? We think that whilst these two bodies of thought might not seem to be compatible, we think there are considerable areas of overlap. And in particular, both explore the possibility for the development of order without a specific source of authority. And we're also going to suggest that complexity approaches to political systems undermine the credibility of the realist analytic focus on states as actors in international relations. Now, the full version of this paper, which you certainly are not getting here, starts with quite a lengthy discussion of Waltz's model of international systems, because in some senses he anticipates elements of a complexity approach, but in a very restricted sense. I'll just note here that problematically, he, like many others in IR, are using the term anarchy as a descriptor for the international system. It's linked to the popular stereotype of relative chaos and disorder. And for Waltz, it's only stabilised by a particular kind of international hierarchy, bipolarity. We're going to concentrate, really, on complex systems, anarchism, and our notion of international politics as a complex system. And what we find interesting about complexity science or complexity theory is that it offers the social sciences a way to rework the concept of a system, and it can overcome some of the problems that Waltz encounters. And we also think that it's compatible with both anarchist theory and anarchist politics. So I'm going to start off by thinking about complexity thinking and anarchism, and then Steve's going to draw the paper to a close by applying these ideas to thinking about international systems. So, high-speed complexity theory on the notion of systems, which some of you may know very well, and some of you might not know at all, so you just get this high-speed thing. Okay, so one of the most common elements in a complexity understanding of a system is very simple. It's a distinction between a system and its environment, and it simply means a system has boundaries, it distinguishes itself from everything which is outside it. But the complexity notion of system is as a complex system. So systems are internally complex, and the term emergent properties is used to describe specific properties that we can see at certain levels of systemic complexity which are not apparent at lower levels. And complexity scientists often speak of systems as nested, so you have complex systems within a more complex system, within a more complex system, etc., etc. Oops, no. Further property of a complex system is a tendency to fluctuate between periods of linearity and non-linearity in its development. So in a linear relationship, there's a proportionate relationship between cause and effect. If I was to throw a ball twice as hard, I would expect it to go twice as far. If we have non-linear relations, we don't have such a direct relationship. And complexity theorists talk about this as a sensitivity to initial conditions. So very minor conditions, very minor changes in initial conditions of a system can result in markedly different endpoints. Systems are also seen as open because they utilise a continual flux of matter and energy, exhibiting some kind of closure in maintaining a relatively stable form. There's consistent change, so change is a process in a system through feedback loops which are synthesising new information. These can result in stability, or if there's positive feedback and the change is reinforced, it can result in dramatic shifts. Finally, complexity theorists have used the notion of co-evolution to describe how, rather than simply impacting on one another, as you might think of in a hierarchical model of how systems relate, systems have complex reactions to other systems. So all these individual interacting systems are changed in quality by their interaction. So we think these concepts allow us to think about systems with various levels of emergent properties and powers. We don't have to presume that relationships between levels are fixed or that they're hierarchical. And in addition, there's a presumption that systems interrelate, that they overlap each other, they may exist within each other, and they co-constitute each other. There's no idea that a system has to be static, as in the infamous work of sociologists like Torquil Parsons, but there's this idea that systems are constantly changing and remaking themselves. What's this got to do with anarchism then? So a key insight of complexity approaches is this idea of self-organisation, the idea that order or pattern can arise without a specific orderer. And we think there's considerable overlap here with key anarchist contributions, in particular the work of Kropotkin and Butchin, although I would say Butchin to a lesser extent. So the work of Kropotkin in particular, mutual aid, and the notion of sociability has been talked about quite a bit so far, but we think this notion can actually equate quite closely to the notion of self-organisation in complexity theory. And the more I reread Kropotkin, the more complexity I seem to be finding, but maybe, of course, that's just because we find what we're looking for. Okay, self-organisation points to the tendency of units or systems to interact with each other and produce ever more complex systems. And I think we can see this in Kropotkin's work and his notion of evolution towards more complex forms of social organisation based on mutual aid. In addition, in Kropotkin, you can see that he has some idea about the co-evolution of systemic relations of social domination, his theory of the development of the state, for example, or the theory of the development of capitalism is co-constituted with a range of political institutions and relations. And I think in Kropotkin we can see social relations of oppression as both systemic and multiple, as overlapping. Butchin, of course, extends many of the themes that we see in Kropotkin, elaborating the way in which social hierarchies are embedded, perhaps not so closely embedded as he thinks, in environmental contexts. And Butchin clearly sees a process of change, active and evolutionary processes that a complexity theorist would recognise. He talks about the interlinked developments between the species which evolve, as he says, in creatively interactive relations. But also very important for Butchin, of course, is the notion of hierarchy, which is a human property, which is institutionalised and highly ideological. And Butchin provides in his magnum opus this long story of the development of hierarchical social relations which are overlapping, which are co-constituting in terms of relations of ethnic hierarchy, class, caste, gender, etc., etc. So in some ways, we think, complexity theory is latent in both mutual aid and the ecology of freedom. But if you look at Butchin's, and Butchin specifically references complexity science, but he doesn't use it in quite a complexity way. So Butchin's model of interrelated domination is still on a linear model. He's influenced by complexity theory. He uses the concepts, but he does have problems with it, and he's particularly concerned that complexity theory, and he's rightly concerned here, doesn't entail a particular political project. Complexity theory, which we've written about elsewhere, is so multivariate. Social theorists have used it in all kinds of different ways. Butching's alarmed that it's been used to bolster theories which he sees as postmodernist, and of course makes him mad. But we think you don't, you can use certain kinds, there are different complexity approaches, you can use certain kinds to think about the ways multiple systems of social domination are co-constituted, overlapping, and don't have necessarily a predictable trajectory. And we also think that it's important in understanding human communities in a complex network of relations with non-human systems. So we can do exploitation, domination, overlappingness, and embedding in natural systems. And how long have I got?
You go for that.
We're doing all right then. So what? I think at first we thought both Kropotkin and Butchin might have found Gunnison and Holling's notion of panarchy useful, but I'm not quite so sure Butchin might, actually. I think Kropotkin might have quite warmed to it. But they're quite interesting because they're scientists moving their theory into the social realm. And their notion of a panarchy is that you have these complex configurations of all kinds of different sorts of systems that are internally dynamic, non-static, co-constitutive, but they also mark out some distinguishing features that they think exist between ecological systems and human systems without this kind of prejudice, I think, Butchin has for keeping what is distinctly human and what is distinctly natural and animal very much separate. What's this got to do with international relations, Steve, in 5 minutes?
Okay, right, well, Eric has done the hard bit. I'm doing the speculative bit, which is trying to kind of take some of these ideas that we've developed in the first part of the paper and apply them to thinking about international systems. And this is just work in a sense that we're kind of just starting or was trying to think about a complex way, complex theory approach to think about international systems. And we found, you know, in engaging with anarchist thought, a lot of ideas which in fact kind of hopefully will sort of resolve some of the weaknesses that we found in complexity theory. I'm going to go through this quite quickly. In this part of the paper, basically, we talk about four potential kind of contributions in terms of thinking about international systems. And in the paper, we posit this as a kind of critique of the sort of Malthusian approach. And of course, the first thing is that complexity theory demolishes this idea that sort of states are black boxes or billiard balls, as Erica talked about, you know, in the part of the paper. Complexity theory sees systems as open systems that co-evolve. Not only that, you have nested systems, so the international system, the state system, is all embedded in a whole range of different social and human and non-human and world systems as well. So this analysis, you know, kind of completely undermines that sort of billiard ball black box approach. That's the first point. Second point is kind of to start thinking about some of those possible emergent properties of the international system. And in the paper, we talk about three. The first is, and I have some kind of concerns about this, is the sort of emergence of balance of powers in international systems, kind of old sort of realist notion. But, you know, a number of writers point to the emergence of balance of power over time in different configurations. A second emergent property perhaps would be something that we talked about quite at length yesterday, is international organisation of various different forms. But, you know, the kind of emergence of norms, rules, supra-governmental organisations like the European Union, the World Trade Organization, and so on. These kind of institutions, and I think most writers on international relations make the observation that There's been a vast increase of these numbers of institutions since the beginning of the 19th century, and they are becoming increasingly sort of complex and having increased amount of impact on kind of state, not only the activities of states, but also other international actors. The third emergent property that we talk about, and here the kind of contribution from anarchists thought, I think is very important, is various different sort of systems of domination, patriarchy, racism, the economic system. So all of these we would also kind of look upon as sort of emergent features in the international system. Two other contributions from complexity theory in thinking about international systems would be this distinction between linearity and non-linearity. Waltz's approach to think about international systems was decidedly linear in the sense that he had this view that, you know, that different forms of polarity would result in different forms of international system. Well, a complex approach would come as to, you know, there's going to be no link between how many great powers there are and the kind of form of relationship that they would have. The final point is that we discuss the analysis of feedback. Feedback is an important contribution from complexity theorists. Most realists have talked about negative feedback, those sort of features which bring systems back into equilibrium. For complexity theorists, positive feedback is equally, perhaps not more so important, those sort of features which take systems away from equilibrium rather than moving towards equilibrium. So, very rapidly to conclude, I mean, the point of the paper was to sort of draw out some of these similarities and complementarities between complexity approaches, various different kinds, and anarchist thinking. And we have the view that there's room for a considerable kind of contribution, you know, considerable dialogue and conversation between complexity theorists and people who are interested in anarchist approaches. And we have kind of shared concerns, it seems to me, the analysis of systems and social organisations that don't have an order. What do the two sides kind of bring to the table in terms of this conversation? Well, I think from complexity theory, we have very detailed analysis and discussions of the way that system self-organises, how self-organisation can appear in social systems. What does anarchist thinking bring to the table? Well, it's the analysis of hierarchy and the ways that hierarchy has kind of developed and emerged. And in Kropotkin's work and Bookchin's, a very, very detailed analysis of how hierarchic systems have emerged. And I think those fit very, very nicely with complexity approaches.
All right, well, last paper for today is by Nathan Ostertag from Bristol.
Definitely.
Just going to get April online.
Can you pass on the mouse?
If we can get people to act like they're talking. Yeah. Or the website. So don't look at the screen. You know, just, I don't know.
Okay, do that again. or maybe point at the screen as if you're presenting something that's up there. Don't look at me though.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I'm on the wall.
Can I move yet?
Okay. Oh, she's not there, so.
They're going to see that photo.
Yeah, why, I know. Why is he party?
You may continue.
Okay, so the paper's called Anarchism as Assemblage, and it's about the paradoxes of emancipatory governmentalities. So I'm going to just kind of try and get my teeth straight into the content. So that does mean skipping over quite a bit of the initial stuff, laying out some of the terminology. So if there's any questions with that, please don't hesitate to ask at the end. So the assemblage, briefly, the assemblage concept's been picked up in the global governmentality literature as a way of conceptualizing neoliberalism and globalization, a way of conceptualizing diffuse, internally inconsistent objects without reifying those concepts, without creating some essential object. I've kind of met some of these approaches with a bit of, I've found them problematic because they've critiqued, problematized empowerment and participation to the degree that all forms of empowerment feel untenable. They all seem like such a governmental intervention that it's like, how can we even think empowerment? How can we think participation in a way that isn't just another articulation of domination? So in this piece, I wish to resurrect empowerment, because anarchists are concerned with empowerment, whilst recognizing its disciplinarity. And I think that unless we can do that, unless we can make normative claims about better and worse forms of empowerment, then we're either stuck with what we've got, or we're constantly dreaming of some totalizing impossible future. So my central claim is that anarchism as global assemblage provides a useful way of thinking the disciplinarity or incompleteness of emancipation. And as such, anarchism is more governmental than most anarchists would like to think. But it's also more emancipatory than most governmentality theorists would have us believe. So briefly, I think in a similar way that the complexity theory is a useful way of thinking anarchism, I'm proposing the assemblage theory is a good way of thinking anarchism. Anarchism's assembled from heterogeneous elements, theories, ideas, practices, ways of being in the world, ways of acting and interacting towards the other. It's the assemblage, thinking through assemblages allows us to think the way in which these diverse elements are drawn together. It's anti-essentializing, and it allows for paradox, irony, and constituted tensions to be integral elements to our analysis rather than some kind of problem that we have to constantly push into a singular narrative. But importantly, and I think the big difference is that the assemblage concept flags agency. And so this is why it's been important to governmentality theorists. And so I propose in the paper that this agency operates along two registers. This governmental character operates along two registers. One is the way in which anarchism as an identifiable terrain of thought and action is held together. So we might talk about all these, you know, different, this ensemble of heterogeneous elements, but we're still able to talk of an identifiable object. And so one of the ways in which it's assembled is through people like me, people like you, naming, identifying and naming logics of coherence. So academics, bloggers, zinesters, anyone talking about anarchism saying, no, we can reduce it to these core things are assembled, that is creating anarchism from these diverse elements. Equally, anarchism is performed, people taking action in its name produce that which we come to know as anarchism. But the second sense in which we can think of agency or a governmental character is that which disciplines anarchists and in relation to each other and in relation to our broader goals, in relation to the achievement of broader aims as a movement. And so on that point, I propose that anarchism, like neoliberalism, is a mobile logic of governing, which operates through discourses and practices of empowerment. So this is where people problematize empowerment because they looked at neoliberalism and thought, hang on, these empowerment strategies are actually disciplining people. And I'm proposing that anarchism is a logic of governing that operates through practices of empowerment as well. But also, and crucially importantly, that it's substantively different to neoliberalism. So briefly, why are we concerned with empowerment? It's kind of taken as a given, but just to lay it out, you know, if what anarchism criticizes is domination, you know, not power. And domination is an effect of power, or an effect of authoritarian structures, Newman proposes. Well, authoritarian structures are necessarily hierarchical. There's hierarchical relations involving imbalance of power. Therefore, in order to counter domination, we need to equalize power relations. We need to empower those with less power and disempower those with more. So in a sense, domination is the problem space, it's the problem space in which anarchism is assembled. And the correlative identifiable terrain of action is empowerment. So it kind of relates to this idea of framing as well, framing a situation or rendering it amenable to certain interventions. So in the piece, I identify three strategies of empowerment that anarchists use, and so I'm going to run through those and think briefly about some of the ways in which they discipline anarchists in relation to each other and anarchism in relation to its broader goals as a movement. So the first is self-initiated self-empowerment, so empowering ourselves. So we kind of got to think that pure autonomy is tempered by a recognition of the relationally constituted character of the subject, and by the positionality of the subject. So, you know, everyone isn't equally able to empower themselves because of our different social positions, and we're the subject emerges through the social, so there is no pure autonomous. But having said that, there is a degree of agency. For anarchist self-empowerment refers to the degree to which one has the freedom to eschew the rules of another and cultivate self-discipline. That is, to inculcate and modify so-called technologies of the self in accordance with a moral or ethical frame. So anarchism, like neoliberalism, is concerned with the production of a rational, self-governing subject. Where it diverges, or one of the ways which it diverges most clearly, is through this concept of the inseparability of the freedom of one from the freedom of the other. Bakunin's famous maxim. As such, I'm urged to bridle my passions partly on account of my ethical position of non-domination, you know, that I wish to fulfill this ethical position, but partly because if I accept that my freedom is bound up with yours, then my domination of you is an affront to my own emancipation. So this idea links individual empowerment, self-empowerment, with collective empowerment. And similarly, modes of collective empowerment can work to police the group, through the inculcation of particular norms, participatory consensus decision making is a disciplinary form of self-management. You know, it maximizes participation, minimizes domination, but you know, it's also about suppressing the will of the minority so they can't dominate the majority, and vice versa. Similarly, a vegan cafe operationalizes the value of inclusivity by providing the food stuff that everyone can eat, the lowest common denominator. So whilst these interventions are driven by an egalitarian ethic, they're nonetheless governmental, in that they, certain modes of organisation, certain modes of behaviour are necessarily and willfully excluded. Where they differ from neoliberal governmentalities, is that individuals and groups are seizing the ability to govern themselves in their own terms and not being granted empowerment by a higher authority. And there's an openness and reflexivity regarding the rationale for empowerment. And so this makes the constant modification of practices possible. Many of the things that we do today, such as rotation of roles, a number of things emerge in response to Freeman's critique that we've talked about, you know, the tyranny of structurelessness. But crucially, these modified practices engender new forms of discipline at the same time as they facilitate more equal and more empowering interactions. So the two can't be separated. Secondly, the second form of empowerment I want to talk about is the empowerment of others. Now, you know, the promotion or facilitation of the empowerment of others. Now, this is eminently more problematic for anarchists. You can imagine why. Empowerment that takes place between two subjects whose initial starting point of power is unequal in relation to each other is, you know, your jumping off point is one of inequality. You know, reminiscent of the politics of hegemony, it's not uncommon for a specialist or expert activist to conceive of themselves as facilitating the liberation of others, a supposedly disempowered, non-political, non-politicized subject from the chains of which they're unaware. So, noting this critique, can empowerment, when the initial relations of power that we begin with are unequal, can we even conceptualize that? Well, I'd hope so, because as a white male academic, if it was impossible for that to happen, then I'd just sit here and drink Coca-Cola and wait for the revolution to happen. So it's difficult, but it's something we do need to engage with. So Bueller, in response to sort of similar critiques in development, argues that we need a genuine dialogue. And a dialogue involves listening, but listening that isn't just about the unquestioning valorization of the other, which is equally patronizing. So I'm sure people have been in meetings, or, you know, in activist meetings, where a community member comes, and suddenly the community member is unquestioningly valorized. You know, everything they say is gold dust. And so by doing this, we hold up people who don't associate with an activist identity as some kind of valid representative of a mythical community. In doing so, we actually create a we-them division, which separates them from us and says that if you want to participate in this, you can't be a normal member of the community. You have to have an activist identity. So in such case, you know, our practices of empowerment aimed at including others reproduce the exclusionary relations they attempt to resist. And, you know, obviously this in turn disciplines the movement as regards to its universalizing ambitions. So, again, these practices can be differentiated from state practices along the lines of the renegotiability in accordance with an ethical frame. Otherwise, making this critique would be utterly pointless because things would just stay the same, and so I wouldn't bother doing it. And also along this idea of the inseparability of the freedom of one from the freedom of the other, which means that I no longer desire, this is the flip side of the other argument, that I no longer desire your freedom on the basis of charity or some innate concept of the good. I don't want you to be empowered because I'm such a great person. I want you to be empowered and free because your freedom's bound up with mine. And so it's freedom and empowerment on the basis of an ethic of solidarity. So it provides a motivational ethics which completely diverges from the notion of the liberal citizen subject whose freedom is dependent on the state. So our third type of empowerment, that is the disempowerment of others, is tricky again, as you can imagine. And I propose that self-empowerment and the facilitation of the empowerment of others is only one aspect of an anarchist praxis that aims to minimise domination. As William Burroughs poetically quipped, the people in power will not disappear voluntarily. Giving flowers to the cocks just isn't going to work. You know, the state isn't going to wither away. Multinationals aren't going to wither away if we're going to set up social centres. We need to do that as well, but we also need to make a proactive attack. And so, you know, taking these kind of actions which aim to sort of disrupt the flows of state and corporate power are empowering in the two senses mentioned thus far, but they're also empowering in the sense of disempowering those conceived to have too much power. So this, of course, is eminently governmental as well, though in a more traditional sense to that which was referred to in the governmentality literature. It differs to the extent that it's not an attempt to seize control, as in a Marxist sense, but it's an attempt to diffuse power. So we're not trying to grab their power and use it for other more just purposes. We're just trying to take it away. We're just trying to stop them doing what they're doing. So, shall I conclude? Okay, I'll conclude. Anarchism as global assemblage is a useful way of thinking the disciplinarity of emancipation. Anarchism, like neoliberalism, is concerned with ethical self-formation, but it's a more empowering empowerment on the basis of the concept of the inseparability of the freedom of one from the freedom of all, that it's driven by a different ethico-political rationality, and that that ethico-political rationality is both explicit and persistently renegotiable through reflexive practices. Whilst this doesn't eliminate the governmental character, it minimises the likelihood of domination. So, you know, anarchism departs from its modernist roots not by discarding universals such as freedom and equality, but by departing from them as absolutes or as possible static endpoints. So similarly, government is like power, never absolute, and it's the imperative of anarchists to develop more emancipatory governmentalities.